be here. I've been to many talks here, but it's the first time that I've actually given one, so thank you for the invitation. Mm-hmm. You know, today I want to talk at first about the ICS program as a major and a minor, and the Department of Education Title VI grant that has made it possible. And then I want to talk a little bit about some of the more profound questions that were thrown at me, but I'll wait to the end to do that. So what I'm passing around are some of the accomplishments of the program just through the grant period, which was from 2009 to 2012. It will end officially on August 1st. So this is a Fulbright-Hayes congressional appropriation. It began in 1963, and it covers a whole bunch of different programs. For example, the Fulbright that, for example, Brooke Broswell just won to Tajikistan. She just found out last night that she'll be a Fulbright scholar to Tajikistan. Congratulations, Brooke. And she is an ICS major, so we're particularly proud of her. And we have another success, Ryan Folio, who's not here, but he won a Fulbright to Jordan. So two in a very small program is amazing. I think BC now has 14 this year and counting. So it's going to be one of our banner years. So the program covers dissertations, faculty exchanges, and it covers the program that we have and we got our funding under, which is called Useful, undergraduate international, I can never remember what this stands for, but undergraduate international studies and foreign languages, right? So that's the Useful program. Now, there were a lot of budget cuts, you might have heard, and so the Useful program was slashed in half. So whereas normally you would have 30 schools that win these appropriations, now they'll cut it to 15. We were lucky because we were the last year in 2009 where they had a full budget of $4 million and we received $200,000 for a two-year period with a third year no-cost extension, and that then had to be matched by BC funds. So the total amount of the grant is something just under $400,000. So you can do a lot with $400,000 in 2 years. Not everything that you want to do, but it certainly is very good seed money. It's quite unfortunate. We were just to a conference of program directors for the Useful program, and last year there was $0 appropriated for Useful. So that means there was no competition whatsoever. And then, worse than that, the nightmare of all nightmares was the group just after us, so they would be in their second year of their grant now, were told that their appropriation was sliced in half. So schools that got $80,000 were suddenly told in the middle of the grant that they would receive only $40,000. So that put big holes in programs that were already ongoing. And thank goodness we missed those problems. So we already had an ICS, or as it was called, Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies minor at BC. And it was a very successful program. I've got some numbers on that sheet going around. You can see that we're up to almost 75 minors. It's an interdisciplinary minor program. And so we decided around 2007 that we really ought to make it a major, especially since students were already, in fact, accumulating enough courses so that they had a major. In 2008, we had 4 students who did a design your own major, which the university does not appreciate, but they had to approve it anyway. And so we thought, well, you know, we should really give it more structure and ask the Educational Policy Committee to pass our proposal. And they did. It took a while. I think it took them a year and a half of back and forth, but eventually it did happen. And that's when we decided to go ahead and put our proposal in for a second useful grant. And that happened, as I said, in August 2009. So we asked for, we told the our proposal included 6 points that we were going to work on, and I think most of them we've successfully achieved. So one was the expansion of the Arabic language program, which only had 2 years of Arabic, and we wanted 4 years, and then we also wanted some specialized Arabic language, so business Arabic, newspaper Arabic, research Arabic, dialect Arabic. These are all important because students go abroad, and when they return, their Arabic is far too advanced for us to accommodate them. So we did increase the number of Arabic language offerings, but then we also felt that it was important for students to have the opportunity to learn at least Persian and Turkish. So the Slavic and Eastern Languages and Literature Department was very accommodating. They found ways to offer these languages, and as you can see on the sheet, more, through something called an independent language study, which is a 1 or 2 credit course where you would spend a lot of time in the language lab, and then once a week a native speaker would spend about an hour, and many of them gave much, much more than just an hour. But it was the beginning, anyway, of language acquisition for students in languages such as we've taught Urdu, Pashto. This is how Farsi Dari began, and now has become a full 3-credit elementary and intermediate language program. So the seed money there worked, I think, very well. As I'll talk about later on, the challenge is that that has to continue. And without the grant money, it means that the university has to pick up those courses rather than simply drop them and leave students in the middle of the stream without a horse or a paddle and unable to continue the language that they picked up initially. The second thing is curriculum development, and here we wanted to introduce a series of new electives. We ended up with 13 new electives over the 2-year period in a wide variety of departments, from theology to history to political science to fine arts, many of them very creative. And this was done, again, by seed money in what's called teaching, advising, and mentoring grants. So you can apply for a grant, BC would match it, and you would take a year to develop a course and then teach it. So those 13 courses came because of that money. Thirdly, we wanted to, and this was difficult, in this environment it was certainly difficult, but we wanted to increase the number of full-fledged foreign partnerships that Boston College has with overseas universities. So as soon as we proposed this, of course, the Arab uprisings all took place. BC students had to be evacuated from Cairo, and OIP didn't think it was such a good idea to start expanding those programs. Nonetheless, we are exploring, and in fact, Eric is coming with us this summer on a trip to Turkey to partially talk to officials at Boğaziçi University in Istanbul, and I do think that partnership will pan out. Otherwise, students have to go on external programs, and they've done that, and they've done that most creatively, and they've done a very good job. So we do have 2 students now in an external program in Cairo. We have a lot of students in Jordan. We've had students in Oman, Kuwait, and other places. In the summer, students will go even farther afield to Tajikistan. We had a student who traversed Central Asia, started in Azerbaijan, and then ended up in Afghanistan. And that was accomplished by what we designated as an ICS travel and research grant. So this, I think, was the most successful part of our program, honestly, and I think the students would agree. The problem is that the federal government limits you to 20% of the total amount of the grant, so $40,000 are the funds that can be distributed to students who send us proposals about language acquisition and a research project. And the research project does have to fit into your senior thesis. So we gave probably 10 or 12 of those a year, ranging from $500 to $2,500. And students came back with amazing projects. And again, I did include them in those packages, those packets that I handed out. The research projects were very creative, very innovative, very adventuresome. They showed a great deal of knowledge on the students' parts about the nuances of Middle East politics and religion and history and fine arts and all the other components to our program. So they really should be applauded for what they did. And I am afraid that this is a part of the program that is not sustainable. So and that's. You know, we are looking for new grant money for this sort of endeavor. And I don't understand why the federal government limits the total amount that can be used for student research and travel, but nonetheless, they do. So we also wanted to include new summer study abroad run by BC faculty, and we ended up with several courses, my own course to Kuwait, which several students around the table have gone on. There was one in Jordan, where else? Israel, and there's a new one to Granada. So those also were very successful, and those are sustainable. The other thing we wanted to do was to have a distinguished lecture series, and that was very successful, but very exhausting. I think we had something like, 50 or 60 lectures over the three-year period. And again, that's included in your packet, so you can see who we brought in. Fifthly, we wanted to do more in terms of student advisement, publicity, mentoring, communication. We tried to integrate students from the Lynch School of Education and CSOM. This proved to be our great failure. It just didn't happen. I think we'll try again. We probably didn't do enough, but there's just not enough reaching across schools at BC. And there's almost a distancing of schools so that people don't seem to be comfortable to come to take courses in ANS. So that really didn't work out. But I do think the advisement, mentoring, placement, our students are getting into PhD programs, Fulbrights, critical language scholarships. There's a lot of money out there if you're interested in this part of the world, and our students have been successful in taking advantage of that. We have students who are placed in the State Department, who work with NGOs. One of our students who's coming in next week to talk to our undergrads is now the political affairs officer in Baghdad, and next year we'll move to Cairo in a sort of lateral transition. So this, I think, placement and networking to help current students understand what jobs are out there and what they can do with their interests. Because if you don't hear of the stories, you don't hear what people are doing, it's really kind of hard to envision, what you do except for perhaps teaching. you know, and some students really don't want to do that. They want to be more active. They want to do rather than teach. So so placement has been something that's successful. We instituted an alumni networking program, and then, of course, there's all kinds of social media. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. Not me, because I have no idea how any of this works. But I just say to the students, go do Twitter, and they do. They blog from abroad. They post internships. They use Facebook. There's a LinkedIn account. I mean, we've really tried everything, and everything works. Social media is a great thing for communication. It works a lot better than sending emails or announcing things in class or putting up flyers, which today, you know, is almost a waste of money. I think part of it, the mentoring part, has worked well. And then finally, I already talked about innovative technologies, but I do want to say that there's a couple things that are new. One is in our foundation course, which is Islamic civilization. The two professors that have taught it, Bloom and Blair, and Sajdi, three professors, have used Wiki. I'm not sure how this works. They explained it to me, but I'm not, unless you participate in it, I don't think that you get it, or I don't get it. They assign students a city and in the Middle East or in the world of Islam, and students create an account and they go in and they can change it, they can critique it, and it's an ongoing device that they use throughout the entire semester to put together a project that anybody in the class can add to or critique and really criticize. So that has worked well. I run a crisis simulation, which is interesting in two of my classes, in my Central Asian class and in my course on the Middle East. And this promotes a kind of active learning. So I think at the end, students really, they have to participate, they have to play the role of a Middle Eastern leader or a foreign policy official in a Middle East country or a Central Asian country. And I give them a series of crises over the course of a week, and they have to resolve the crises, or they don't really resolve them. We've gone to war many, many times. So they've been resolved in violent ways. But we also have had peace between Israel and Palestine, Central Asian states dissolved and made one big new country called Turkestan. So the sky's the limit, but it's fun, it's active, it promotes active learning, it's collaborative, there's a lot of teamwork, and students really get into it and play the roles, and I think that's something that I'll continue, and I would encourage others to do this kind of dynamic learning. Okay, challenges, there's a lot of challenges. Just understanding the financial aspect of the grant and being responsible for that much money and trying not to get arrested. And for that, I have Susan Leonard to thank. She's our fiscal specialist, and she has kept me out of jail on numerous occasions. It's easy to slip up on some of these things. There's so much documentation, and there's this whole IRIS system where you have to go in and get everything pre-approved. Just keeping track of how much money was spent, how much more do we have, and revising this on an almost daily basis. So Susan she sends me Excel spreadsheets every other day. And so she's the one who really keeps us on the straight and narrow. And then our goal, of course, is to spend every single penny, because if you don't by a certain date, then you have to give it back. Right? But if you go over, then there's all kinds of penalties that you pay. So it's really, you have to fine-tune it, especially toward the end. Another problem that we went into was we're an interdisciplinary program. So all of our faculty are housed in departments, traditional departments. And it's difficult to be an interdisciplinary program because people think of you last. Your faculty thinks of you last. When they make changes in their curriculum, when they, for example, the Slavic Language Department decided that they were going to change Arabic from 3 credits to 4 credits to 6 credits, back to 5, and now it's back to 6. I usually find out about this 3 months after the fact. So what happens is when we submit materials to the university on the website and the catalog, my numbers in terms of credits and courses are always wrong, always. And it's not through any fault of their own. It's just that we're so pipelined that we don't think of informing others who are affected. The people, faculty devise new courses all the time, and I find out through students. You know, students will say, oh, isn't this course on terrorism? Shouldn't that be? What course on terrorism? You know, yeah, okay, we'll add it. So students are the best people, I think, to rely on for information. You know, sometimes there's rumors and innuendos going on, but if you check it out, it usually is good, solid information, and so it's always good to talk to students. They know a lot, and a lot more than we give them credit for. So that the communication, coordination is extremely difficult. I would also say that funding is now going to be a problem. So the grant runs out. It was seed money. We started a lot of programs, and again, we're in a difficult environment in terms of part-time faculty hires. And we rely, especially in the language program, you know, the person who teaches Turkish or Farsi or the literature course or Urdu, they're part-time instructors. And all of their salaries came from the grant money. That's gone. So, as I said, especially in terms of language, we're offering, say, elementary Turkish, and now next year we're pulling Turkish. So a student who was going to have their university core language requirement covered by 2 years of Turkish is now out of luck. And they've got to start all over again with a different language. Or they can go to BU or one of the other consortium schools, but we all know, you know, how problematic that is. So funding after the grant, I don't know yet what is going to happen, what BC can pick up. I'm sure that our programs are going to have to be curtailed. And so we are going to have to start looking for new forms of funding. One would think that a program that is centered in the Middle East, largely, and in the Gulf, because of our programs in Kuwait and so forth, wouldn't have any problems with money. But in fact, that's not the case. So we'll see. Grant funding is again one of those very difficult things. And fundraising is one of the goals that we're looking at. We've also been given the green light to make a proposal for a master's program in ICS. So that's something we'll work on over the summer. I think that's an element or a litmus test, really, of our success. That we, from a little tiny minor program, which required just 6 courses, that now we have a major, and we're looking at a master's program, but a major that where most departments require 30 credits, we require 54. We require language, and we require 2 years of language. We require a senior thesis. So if you can't write the senior thesis, you don't graduate with an ICS major. And we require original research. 100% of our students study abroad. It's not a requirement. We can't require that, but they do anyway, and they find ways to find funding to go abroad. Okay, and then lastly, and very briefly, so I was asked a few sort of broader questions. What role should the study of religion play in liberal education? And to what extent should the U.S. government promote the study of religion at the university level? And what are the challenges of teaching Islam in a Catholic university? All right, so I think I can knock all of those, or at least try to answer. And these are very complicated questions, but I sort of am going to roll them all together. I guess I would start by saying that religion is important in the world today. I think it was The Economist, and Alan, you probably know this better than I do, but or Time Magazine, I think it was The Economist, who wrote God's Obituary about 15 years ago. And then maybe 5 years ago, retracted it. I just read a statistic that the proportion of the world's population that is claiming membership in one of the four largest religions in the world, so Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism, increased over the past 50 years from 67% to 73%, and it's predicted or projected to reach 80% by 2050. So 80% of the world's population that claims membership in one of those four religions. Yeah, 80%. So it's increasing people's feeling or participation in a particular religion, and not just, you know, the sort of ephemeral spirituality, but actual participation in one of these faiths. Is increasing and has increased for the past 50 or 60 years. 50% of universities today now have departments of religious studies. And when we went to the conference of program directors, I was surprised, I guess, that so many of the state universities and public universities had used the grant money to establish departments of religious studies. And that was their main goal. I felt that we had a leg up and head start being a Jesuit university. We didn't have to make up a department of religious studies. We already have a theology department. And we already have an awareness of the part that religion plays. And so we didn't have to go through all of that. And I thought that was something that put us in an advantageous position. I also think that the Jesuits have been, just in terms of Islam, they've been very involved in the Middle East. I gave a talk recently at Campion Center, which is the retirement home for Jesuits, and I cannot tell you how many of them had served in the Middle East for a very long time and were fluent in Arabic, and were still fluent in Arabic. And when you walk down the hall, there were pictures of Baghdad University and Saint Joseph and other Jesuit places in the Middle East, and it was really very impressive. They were my toughest audience because they knew a lot about the Middle East. There has been this Jesuit tradition of being interested in other areas of the world and other religions and taking a comparative approach to religion. So, you know, teaching about religion, but not teaching religion. And I think that there's a distinction. Some call teaching religion the seminary approach, which is a kind of rhetorical experience, but teaching about religion is something quite different. I noticed that in the theology department, we have something called the religious quest. A couple years ago, we had two sections of Religious Quest. If you look in the catalog today, I think we have 12 sections of Religious Quest. So there is a great interest in this. Why study religions? Why is there this interest? Should there be this interest? You know, certainly in terms of Islam, you can't understand the world of Islam. You can't understand the Muslim Middle East unless you study Islam in a comparative way. It's central to the identity, the politics, the history, the culture, the art of the region, and it's also at the heart of interdisciplinary studies. You know, so I think there's a lot of good reasons to include just for academic, intellectual purposes. I also think it's important to study religion, religions, for the purpose of, I don't know, what's called today maybe being a global citizen. You know, it's important to understand different faith traditions. It deepens your intercultural literacy, your cultural sensitivity, your awareness. It gives you global perspective. It might help you get a job, actually, to look at it more pragmatically. It focuses you on big questions. You know, these are big and deep questions of faith. And different ways in which people look at the world and themselves and their place in it, and you know, the divine and death. You know, don't tell me you don't think about death. You have to, you know. And that brings in religious notions, even if you're not part of an organized religion. It has to do with moral reasoning and lived behaviors and the application of all of this in a global context. And I think these are the aims of a liberal education. BC has a mission statement, and one of the things it says is that we want to be engaged in the globalization or the internationalization of the curriculum. And if we take that seriously, then it has to mean more than having more foreign students, you know, being admitted, or more of our students studying abroad. So that quantitatively, here's one right here. So that, you know, quantitatively, you add it all up and you say, oh, 20% of the population of BC students is from abroad, or so many, 50% or 60% of BC students go study abroad. I mean, this is rewarding to university presidents and to the trustees, you know, because it's cash cow, or it's something that will increase your rankings in the, you know, U.S. News and World Report. But that it's got to mean something more than that, and hopefully BC takes it seriously enough so that it does mean more than that, and I'm hoping that their support of the ICS program, for example, is a an indication of their commitment. So I think the internationalization of the curriculum has more to do with student learning, and that's not quantifiable. That's something that's more difficult to capture, because we have to ask the question, how well are we preparing with such programs students to live their lives, to live and work abroad, or to live and work in a global society, in a culturally diverse world, or to be, as I called it before, a global citizen. How were students' understandings and attitudes affected by internationalization and by the things that we can teach them beyond just increasing numbers in certain areas? So yes, I think it's extremely important in many, many ways that we become not only internationalized, but that we study the traditions and the faiths and the religions of the places that we go to, because we're not going to understand them if we simply factor that part of people's lives out. I think that people in other cultures aren't as ashamed of religion as we tend to be, or some of us tend to be in the United States. And I think that brings us to the last question, which is, you know, the study of religion and a liberal education. And sometimes I think that we tend to suggest that a liberal education and religion cannot go together, that they're mutually exclusive, that if you have a liberal, or if you are a secular humanist or liberal, that religion has to be, as Voltaire said, crushed. That it has to be privatized, that it has to be removed from public life altogether. That's the name of our center, right? Religion and public life. And I think that is the wrong way to look at it. Rather than the strict secularization or separation of religion and public life, I think that there's a role for religion. And it's a role that John Stuart Mill, in his letter on toleration, would appreciate. I was mentioning before that I just read a book by Christopher Hitchens, which some of you may be familiar with, in which he, and I know that there is a whole series of writers who sort of have the same idea, but they formulated, or they say, that religion is a form of mental illness, right? Because it's based in ignorance and superstition, and you can't prove any of these arguments. They can't be defended on rational grounds, and so you must be crazy. And so the other side, then, to be a secular liberal is to make all your arguments that have reason and evidence and proof and so on. I just read another paper by Michael Gillespie, who's talking tonight, I think, and tomorrow. He argued that, in fact, liberalism at its core is religious, or it comes from religious notions. And you can see this in Hobbes and Locke, for instance, and the idea of the individual. You know, liberalism stems from the notion that human beings have dignity, that they're unique, that they have rights and freedoms. But where does this come from? It comes from a religious notion that says that people are unique because they're creatures of God. They're created in the likeness of God, right? So Gillespie argues that the two intersect far more than they admit or want to admit to one another. So that there are, you know, several ways in which today people in the United States think about religion. One is complete separation of church and state, complete secularism, where religion doesn't play a role at all, or the evangelical notion that people argue that religion doesn't play enough of a role. But those two traditions, you know, can come together. Now, there's another tradition in Islam that says, and it's a radical tradition and a very minority tradition, that says that, you know, the state has to be ruled by religious, a clerical class. And we're not talking about kind of radical idea. I guess if a liberal society means anything, it means that we understand religion. We understand different religious views. We understand, in an intellectual sense, the viewpoints of people who profess different religions, and that we are tolerant and inclusive and celebrate this kind of diversity. So my answer, I guess, to the question is, you know, why should the U.S. government you know, give funds to institutions, universities that have religion as part of its program. I think it's for precisely these reasons, you know, to raise citizens and to teach students that this kind of diversity, if you understand different religious beliefs, is something to celebrate. And that's it.
Thank you.